Denise DeHommel is professor of English at Florida International University and the author of numerous poetry collections, including Ka-Ching, Two and Two, and A Queen for a Day, Selected and New Poems. DeHommel has written 5 chapbooks of poetry and co-edited with Maureen Seaton and David Trinidad, Saints of Hysteria, A Half-Century of Collaborative American Poetry. The recipient of numerous awards, including an NEA fellowship, she has been anthologized widely. DeHommel is a guest editor for Best American Poetry of 2013. Welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And this is your second appearance because the first book, Ka-Ching, the first Denise DeHommel book that I fell in love with, we talked about November, I think it was.
I think it was October, yes, in 2012.
Yeah, and your new book just came out. It's called Blowout, and it's also part of the Pitts Poetry Series. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. But first, where are you today? Are you in you're in Florida?
I'm in Florida today, yes. I'm home.
And you teach at Florida International University. You teach poetry, creative writing there, yes?
Yes, I do.
But I'm holding in my hand a copy of Blowout, your latest book, and Blowout blew me away. It's a beautiful book. It touches on a lot of themes, but it seems to be centered on this relationship gone bad, on a divorce. And the book starts with a poem called How It Will End, which I think is an apt title not only for the poem itself, but for the theme of the book, because this marriage is about to end on this poem. We see a couple, and they're observing another couple on the beach, and the couple is fighting. And the way they interpret the fight, you know, we understand immediately is essentially they're talking about themselves, and they're talking about their own marriage. But what I love about the poem is when the language works both on the observed and the observer at once, like the line that goes, "My husband says he's doing the best he can." He's talking about himself in that line, but the next line goes on to say that he's a lifeguard, for Christ's sake, and suddenly the line goes back to the observed. And I love how that works on both levels, because it makes the entire landscape really about something else. Was this a difficult book to write?
Yeah, it was actually. I mean, it wasn't difficult to write, but it was difficult to order and then decide to publish. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a way, I could have just skipped this book completely. You know what I mean? The way you want to skip these things in your life. But I also felt like I had written so much about relationships before. Mm-hmm. And I think writing the poems were not as difficult as one might think. I mean, I think it was really actually helpful to write the poems. But then, like, looking at them over time is difficult. And trying to see, like, is there even a book here? And, I mean, that kind of thing. I mean, How It Will End, I wrote way before I even knew. It was so, sometimes I think poems, for me, say more than I even know.
Right.
Like, if you would have said, like, this poem, I think, first appeared in maybe 2006, so I probably wrote it around then. And if you would have said, oh, this poem's about the end of the marriage, I was like, oh, no, the silly fight. I really had no idea. So I think, I know poetry isn't therapy, and you're not supposed to say that, but I think in my case, this really was actually very therapeutic in a strange way.
Right, to
write these poems, like the poems knew something was wrong before I knew something was wrong.
Yeah, that does happen when you go back on something you've written before and you go, oh my God, how did I know that and not know that I knew it?
I knew it, but I wouldn't let myself know it, maybe. I guess that's how it goes.
You know, I recently went through a divorce, very, very recently, and it was.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it was difficult, but one of the ways that I dealt with the pain, the variety of emotions that comes with it, was to write poems. I'm a fiction writer, but suddenly I started writing poems.
Oh, makes sense.
I see that the more distance from the divorce, the more the poems seemed to shift. For example, the first ones might be, for me, were full of a lot of anger. But then after a while, you know, it seems as if somehow we're following these stages of grief, I guess you could say.
Yes, right.
And we end up with acceptance, and we end up with a really peaceful and beautiful, somehow, conclusion to all the sadness. And your book seems to do that. I love the last poem. It's called Ode to Your Eyebrows.
Yeah.
And the penultimate poem, of course, I think leads perfectly into that poem, the penultimate poem, is called Having a Diet Coke with You. Was this conscious to make it such a positive ending?
Yes, it was. I mean, it was almost like, how am I going to get out of this? In a straight, you know what I mean? Like, if you write about death, for example, and then divorce is sort of like a death, like, there has to be a rebirth. I mean, it doesn't have to be, but, I mean, it was either let go at the end or, I mean, there had to be something, right? And in my case, I was just lucky enough that I found, you know, I had a new person to write about. But then it's like this new person, it's sort of like you go in with all the, like, you can't be naive anymore. You know what I mean? Like, you just have to go in, like, going, well, something's going to go wrong, but I'm still going to do it. You know, that sort of attitude, I guess.
In the poem that you write about having a Diet Coke with you, you write that love poems are more difficult poems to write because each love poem contains its opposite, its loss. Mm-hmm. That no matter how fierce the love of that couple, and this is an exact quote, one of them will leave the other, if not through betrayal, then through death. Yet at the same time, the speaker of the poem makes the choice to go ahead and take the plunge again.
Right. That you do have a choice. The choice is, you know, be alone,
right?
Which is an okay choice too, which is like a fine choice actually. But yeah, to go in with your eyes wide open is such a strange. When you first get divorced, you think, forget it. Like, I will never, ever, ever even like say hi to anybody again. You know what I mean?
Right.
You feel really, or I did anyway. I felt so protective, and so scared. And then somehow, like, that healing happens. I mean, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, and what makes the ending of this poem, of this book, so beautiful and so as if the speaker has moved on, and not as if the speaker is hiding the pain, you know, and jumping into another relationship, but has actually moved on. But what makes that so believable and so triumphant is the poems that deal earlier in the book with men trying to pick her up
and her resistance of that.
Yeah, because, you know, she's not ready yet.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's my friends and I have so many friends who are divorced, and the women would say, like someone going through a divorce gives off these, like, needy pheromones. You know? Even though you're a complete mess, there's always some guy going, you know, like that, oh, maybe I can get some whatever. You know what I mean? Like, get a date, because there's something so, like, wrecked about people when they're actually going through. I mean, it's just so painful, right? And I guess that is so apparent.
Yeah, I wonder if that's different for men than for women, because, like, with women, I think men might say, oh, there's a vulnerable spot.
Yes.
You know, but with women, I'm not sure that that same quality would attract them in a man.
Right, unless it's, like, I think for women, this is very, like, stereotypical, and I'm sure there's all kinds of, on the spectrum, that people behave differently. But, like, for women, I've seen women go, like, oh, I can save, oh, the poor thing. And they try to save them. You know what I mean? Maybe that's more the...
Right.
And maybe men do that, too, in a strange way. Men are trying to rescue this person that seems pretty broken.
Let's talk about that poem, Madonna and Me. It's an interesting poem. The speaker of the poem and Madonna are going through a divorce at the same time. And she sees some similarities and differences between Madonna's divorce and her own divorce. And there's also this underlining similarity of the public narrative of the divorce. The poem itself and the book as a whole really turns this divorce into a public narrative. And I'm wondering, was it a difficult decision to make to allow the public narrative to come about with the publication of this book?
Yes. extremely so. It was also very public. Anyway, I mean, in a very small way, of course, compared to Madonna and Guy Ritchie, and it was all over Facebook, and I felt much more exposed than I would have liked to have been, I mean, as it was happening. Mm-hmm. So I think in a way, I felt like, well, not that it's already out there, but it kind of was. I mean, and I probably, in my mind, had more paranoia than I should have, but it felt like everyone... A lot of poets were like, what's going on? I'm not on Facebook, but just through gossip and whatnot.
Right.
So I felt like I was already exposed. So it was, in that way, it was easier to make art out of it than not. You know what I mean? But I think if it hadn't been, it would have been really much, much harder. I mean, it was awful, but it's just the kind of good side of all that awfulness is that people were nice to me. You know what I mean? They're like, oh, no, I heard this and that. You know what I mean?
We had Natalie Goldberg on the show the other day, and she came out with a new book, and a lot of her concept of writing is that it's therapeutic, which is something I've always resisted. You know, I tell my students, if you're writing for purposes of therapy, well, you know, go home and write. And what are you doing in, you know, in an MFA program?
Yes.
But on the other hand, you know, having gone through, you know, a divorce and having lost my father, you know, right before the divorce.
That's exactly what happened to me.
That's weird. That happens a lot.
Yeah. It does happen a lot.
You lose a parent and the divorce follows. That's a strange phenomenon. And I don't think it's consciously done, but it's, you know, I don't know, maybe one death allows the death of another. Who knows?
Yes. Oh, it's fascinating.
But although I've resisted this idea of therapy and writing, when you're a writer, you know, you have to do something with that pain. And the fact is, one of my colleagues, well, you know, Ben, the guy I do the show with, he told me, he says, if it doesn't hurt, it's probably not going to be worth much.
And that's very interesting.
Yeah, and although I'm not sure that I entirely think that's true for everything I've written, you know, I think allowing it to hurt and allowing yourself to express that anger and that denial and all those stages of grief in a poem, you know, it makes for beautiful poetry, but it actually helps. It's therapeutic.
It actually does. It actually does because it's in front of you. I mean, especially if you write and then let time go by and you return to the poem, I mean, it kind of like slays the monster in a way because the monster is kind of in front of you on the page and suddenly you're like, oh, this line break's no good or... Oh. This is really sentimental, and I mean, it helps you to revise more freely or something. I don't know. If you wait and write it 3 years later, and you're already past the situation, that's what everyone says to do, right?
Right, absolutely.
Emotion recollected in tranquility, like, but there's something lost when you're tranquil. I don't know. There's something.
Right, but the key that you just brought up, you said, is, you know, after letting it sit for a while, you return to it. As opposed to the student who wrote the love poem and handed you a love poem and said, you know, and it was sentimental and sappy because she was going through a relationship at that point that she really thought was, you know, the end all. But give it some distance in the revisions. But, yeah, I think you're right. I think there's something about immediately writing it down, immediately letting that pain come out that gives it its own rhythm and it takes over its own. There's a spirit about it. There's something about it that goes beyond you. And it's the revision process that matters. And, you know, and this brings me to another question about these poems. When you're writing them, because it's so public in a sense, and because Denise de Hummel, the poet, is known, I don't want to say you're a confessional poet because your poetry is so much more than anything I could just put into a label. I mean, I love the way you play with punctuation and the way you even draw attention to the punctuation at times just to make a statement on punctuation, like, oh, suddenly here's a comma in my poem. A comma shouldn't be there. I mean, you're much more than a confessional poet, yet at the same time, publicly, some people are going to expect that you're writing about yourself, that you're writing about Denise de Hummel's divorce and her relationship. And I'm wondering what happens at those moments when you're writing and the language takes over and the poem wants to go someplace that has absolutely nothing to do with reality. What do you do at those times?
I think for me, the poem trumps reality.
Right.
So what I tried to do is put in, like, a few poems. The one about Nebraska. There's a poem in the book, you're looking at the love interest. The speaker actually meets a love interest from Megan Dom's memoir. And the speaker is like, oh, my goodness, you're nothing. He actually is proud, even though in the book he's not such a great character, you know. He's not such a sympathetic character. And he says, well, no conflict, no story, right? Like, he's just kind of saying, I'm not as bad as she makes me out to be, because then there wouldn't be a story there. And he just accepts it. So I think by putting in that poem, I'm trying to sort of say, you know, this is just obviously one side of a very complicated story, and kind of almost praying, you know, okay, so this guy's okay with it. You know what I mean? This sort of extension again of that, using projection onto other couples, I guess.
This book is, it's about, you know, divorce, and it's about relationships, but really it goes way beyond that. I think it's a book for women. It's a book that stands up for women. It's a book that speaks for many, many women in relationships. And it's very empowering. This book needed to be written. This book needed to be said. And lest we give people the wrong impression, it's also a very funny book. There's a lot of humor. I love that poem called My Strip Club.
Right.
And it's like what a woman would want to see in a strip club if women were stripping. And can you read that? Do you have your book in front of you? Because I wanted to read it aloud, but I thought, you know what, maybe Denise would be willing to read it.
Okay. So this is a little, like for me, it's a pretty short poem. My Strip Club. In my strip club, the girls crawl on stage wearing overalls and turtlenecks, then slowly pull on gloves, ski masks, and hiking boots. As the music slows, they lick the pole, and for a tantalizing second, their tongues stick because it's so cold. They zip up parkas and tie tight bows under their hoods. A big spender can take one of my girls into a back room where he can clamp on her snowshoes.
I love that poem. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
And I love your version of the VIP dance, right?
Like he has to dress the customer has to actually put more clothes on her.
Yeah, yeah. I have a question about the process on that poem, Sharing the Diet Coke with You, I think it's called. You say the poem was intended to be modeled after Frank O'Hara's Sharing a Coke with You, but it's like the poem wanted to go somewhere else.
Exactly, and, exactly.
I remember I wrote a poem called My Brother's Mething Out Again. And it was I was intended to model it after Daisy Fried's My Brother's Getting Arrested Again. And I know you included her in the anthology, by the way. And I want to talk about that in a bit.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Okay.
But I was even going to go to include the words after Daisy Fried. But
right.
But the poem went somewhere entirely different, and now it looks nothing like Daisy's poem. But I love the idea of addressing where the poem came from in the poem itself. And that poem, it's a long poem. It's like a 3 or 4 page poem. And tell us, where did this poem come from and how it happened? And there's such joy in it. And there's such complexity in it.
Well, I love Frank O'Hara. I mean, he's one of my favorite writers. And I was just reading him, and I was reading Having a Coke with You. And it's just, his poem is one page, I think. And it begins, "Having a Coke with You is more fun." And then his poem is about, we could go to the Met, we could go to Europe, we could go here, we could go there, but just having this Coke with you is more fun than any of those things. So that was my inspiration for the poem. You know, this idea of being so in love that it's just as fun to sit here in the apartment or wherever we are and just drink a Diet Coke. So that was sort of the inspiration for the poem. And then it just kept going and going and going.
The book ends with an image of a lifeguard at a hut, but it's a nicer image than the one at the beginning.
Right.
But it kind of brings the entire book full circle from that very first conflict to the resolution, I sense, in an end. Was that a conscious choice to include that image at the end?
Well, it was in a way because of the way I positioned the poems, but I hadn't even remembered, really, that the lifeguard hut was also in Having a Diet Coke for You. So, I mean, that was, when I put the book together, it was really conscious to be, okay, start with a bad situation in a place and then go back to that same place and reclaim it as something beautiful. I don't know if it was as obvious, but even Ode to Your Eyebrows is sort of, the last poem in the book is, in a way, the beloved in the poem is sort of lifting up his eyebrows, which is body language, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then in the second poem, Super's Light, there's also the speaker trying to read her husband's body language and failing at it.
Right.
You know,
that's a good idea,
like, okay, she's a bit smarter now and can read body language a little bit better. I mean, whether that's true or not in real life, who knows? But I mean, I was trying to do that in the poem as well.
Well, it's amazing the natural form that we have inside of us, and we don't even realize it until we're printing the poems out and putting them all on the floor and looking at the... Do you do that? Do you print out your poems and put them on the floor? And
Oh, yeah. And to put a book together is... I mean, I would rather write 500 poems than put a book together. For me, that's so hard to do.
Oh.
And, I mean, I just resist it. I don't want to do it because I never think... I always forget that I've already done it, and that's fine, and I can do it. But the idea of it is, it's very difficult. But I have a really good friend, Stephanie Strickland, who's another poet, and she and I help each other to put our books together. Because sometimes we see things that the other doesn't see.
Right.
You know, like, oh, you've used the word sparrow 85 times. It's a little much, or whatever. Because I do think our obsessions, you know, for me, it was because I live in Florida, you know, the lifeguard hut, the beach, they just keep reoccurring, you know. Our locale or whatever it is.
You know, I would think that would be one of the most pleasurable parts of putting a book together is printing them out and putting them on the floor, the pages, because you can't do that when you're writing a novel.
That's true. That is true. You got to just put one foot in front of the other,
yeah. Before we go, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the anthology that you're editing, The Best American Poetry of 2013, which is published every year by Scribner and is certainly one of the most important, I think, poetry anthologies series that comes out, and you're the editor this time, and you have people in there that are fantastic. Can you tell us a little bit about being the editor of that series?
Yes. Well, it was an amazing experience, as you can imagine. It was a lot of reading. I feel like I know almost every, I feel like I know almost every poet in the country, which I know is impossible, but boxes of magazines would just come week after week after week. And it was really fun and very, very difficult to choose. And I really tried to ask, I begged David to make it 150 poems instead of 75. It was really that difficult.
Wow.
I know everyone says that, all poems sound the same and poets and this and that, but I found so many really interesting poems.
Who are some of the writers you had to include?
Well, oddly enough, I didn't include them. It's so funny that the ones that... Okay, when I went in, I said to David, I really have to include Sharon Olds and Albert Goldbarth.
Mm.
I love them so much. You know, I feel like they've both been really, big influences. And then they had, hardly any poems this year. So it was really odd. Like, even the people I thought I have to include weren't there. So it was just very odd. It's very, very odd. So I included a lot of newcomers that haven't been in before. So I was really happy about that. Because I know when I was first starting out, I was in Best American Poetry in 1993, and that was the same year my first book came out by a tiny, itty-bitty press that's not even in business anymore. And it was so important to me. So, there's this guy in there. His name is Nathan Anderson, and he wrote this really good poem called Stupid Sandwich. I was like, this has to be, it's just hilarious. It's the first time there's a collaboration in the anthology, so that was really cool. And it's by two people I'd never read before. Their names are Angela Veronica Wong and Amy Lawless. It was funny because I really thought, this person has to be in, and then it didn't happen. So it was a strange and wonderful experience.
It's a great series. I can't wait to look at it. I am on Facebook, and two of my Facebook friends, Paisley Redcall and Daisy Free, both posted when they found out that you included them, and they were very grateful.
Oh, I'm so glad. I am so glad. Paisley's poem is amazing, as is Daisy's. Really,
yeah, they're
really
incredible
strong.
Poets.
Yeah, they really are. They really, really are.
Thank you again. The book is lovely.
It was so great to talk to you.
The book is called Blowout, and it's by Denise DeHommel, brand new. Please check it out. It's a great book. Denise, thank you so much for joining us in Words on a Wire.
Oh, thank you. It's been a blast.